Hello, and welcome to episode 233 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
Artificial intelligence is often framed as a gift of time. Tools that summarize emails, take meeting notes, organize documents, and automate routine tasks promise to free us from busy work so we can focus on the important stuff. And that pitch can be hard to resist. Who wouldn't want fewer tedious tasks and more time for meaningful work? But a recent Wall Street Journal column raised a quieter concern. Our brains aren't built for nonstop high-level thinking, and by eliminating low-intensity repetitive work, we also may be eliminating the mental lull time where creativity, judgment, and insight tend to emerge. Rick, today I want to talk about AI, busy work, and boredom, and whether our rush toward efficiency is quietly costing us something we don't know how to measure. If machines free us from the mundane, what happens to creativity, judgment, and insight, and how much of that loss might we even notice?
The truth is that we really don't know. One of the problems with the speed with which new AI tools are being developed, but then even more importantly, implemented into our both our personal lives and organizational lives and into the workplace, is that these rapid changes are being made to both like how we do our work and how we interact with one another in ways that might be hard to reverse back up if we start seeing negative effects. And we've seen this in other areas with the development of technology, like we've seen with the really rapid adoption of social media and smartphones by teenagers. We found, like, in a very short period of time, profound effects.
That were never predicted.
Never predicted, no. In fact, it was predicted at the opposite effect. You know, all the promises were this would make young people more connected to one another. Ended up just destroying social connection and destroying friendships and causing a great deal of social anxiety. So what's going to happen to everybody with the use of AI, and will creativity suffer? There's good reasons for thinking that, yes, we will become less creative. If you think about how creativity works and when you have your best ideas, it's not when you're most intensely focused on the task. It's whether your mind is kind of released from like some really purposeful activity and it's free to wander a little bit. For me as a writer, the best thing I can do when I'm stuck, when I'm trying to work on a column, is not sit for longer at my computer or at my desk. It's to go and take a walk. And then ideas get worked out that are in ways that are kind of mysterious to me. I don't know how that happens.
So there's two stories I want to tell that kind of make me think about this in a little bit of different ways. So I was talking with a colleague the other day who was working with someone in our company who is very skeptical of AI, that it really has any practical use at all. At the same time, this person who's skeptical of AI had to take like 7 PDFs from different places and merge them into one document for a particular purpose and didn't have the technical know-how to do that and learned, and we're getting more and more frustrated by this and trying to figure it out and just kept getting stuck, and then turned to AI, and AI was able to take these 7 PDFs and stitch them together in one document, and it like took a bunch of frustration off their plate. They were super happy, and the next time something like this comes up, they'll know what to do. And I don't think this person is like an AI evangelist now, but certainly realizes that there are small ways that it can take off this really frustrating work like that. And like, there's never been a journalist in America who got into journalism because they want to merge PDFs into one file. That's something that, like, that's not why they signed up for that job. So I think that can be a good thing. But it also made me think of something else entirely different that actually doesn't have anything to do with AI or journalism, but I think is an important thing to think about. I have long believed that we could do a lot of, and I guess maybe this does have to do with AI now that I talk about it, but we could do a lot better job in our country of automating basic traffic enforcement. You know, when it comes to red light cameras, speed enforcement, I think I've talked about this on the show before. And one of my talking points about why we could and should do that is it would let law enforcement officers focus more on like real important stuff, like investigating and solving crimes. However, I remember talking to a police officer in our community, and I was talking to him and I was telling him the neighborhood where I live, and he said to me, you know, I think he works maybe over a lot of overnight shifts, if my memory serves. And he said that if he's had a busy night dealing with lots of difficult people, maybe as the bars are closing and whatever, there'll be times where he'll, if there's not an active call coming in, he will drive over to the area where I happen to live, which most times is quiet, and maybe sit there for a few minutes and catch up on paperwork or just sort of catch his breath a little bit, because although he may come across something, he knows that it's not the same high stress levels that he would see in other parts of the city. And part of me is like, hey, no, I want you back in those crime-ridden parts of the city, if we have such things where we live. And don't be driving around my neighborhood. Everything over here is fine. But that police officer sort of, I think, intuitively understood that he needed those times on the quiet streets of our city just to sort of calm things down and get him better focused for the next call, which in his job could come in at any minute. So those are really different examples and really different stories. But I think there are times where technology can make our lives better by taking out frustrations. But also, if all we're doing is high-level, intensive, high-demanding work, it can be exhausting, I guess. So what do you learn from those two probably overly long stories?
I think you make a really good point. And we'll continue with the example of law enforcement, because we've actually got some data here where we see that since the development of computers and the ability to kind of track in cities where crimes are happening, where we need more intense police presence and then redirect routes towards those areas, what has happened is these incidences of like these high intensity encounters for most police officers in places that are using that kind of data, and most are, the frequency of those interactions has really increased. At the same time, and there's a direct correlation, burnout, stress, all kinds of mental health issues have really increased within law enforcement. And so we know this with law enforcement. We know it with any kind of job that requires these periods of real high intensity, high focus, sometimes a potential for violence or a potential for danger, anything that increases adrenaline and heart rate, this sorts of things. You can only do this like at certain periods, and then you need the rest time. You need the recovery time.
You need to drive to my neighborhood where it's quiet and rest for a couple minutes.
Yep. So he knows that for himself. We also know this for groups of people. That's just the way it works. And that the danger with AI is that it starts getting implemented in ways that increases this high intensity, kind of high level engagement with whatever our work is, in ways that really increases stress without the opportunity to relieve it. One of the ways we relieve it, I mean, you can go and practice meditation and yoga and things like that, but we also relieve it just by having certain periods of time that are doing kind of boring mundane tasks. And because it's just recovery time. So whether our workplace is going to be good at doing that, I mean, most workplaces look at like the boring repetitive tasks that could be done by, say, a computer program. That just wasted time that I'm paying human beings, you know, for time when they could be engaged in this other stuff. I think we kind of know this, but we don't realize it's how bad it's going to get. And my feeling is, with the implementation of AI very broadly, what we're going to see is an increase in stress and burnout before we start to realize how do we provide some kind of balance.
Because we whether you're working for a public entity like a police department, whether you're working for a private company that has shareholders, efficiency is like something that's talked about all the time. And I would be shocked if this does or already exist in some police departments around the country, but large departments that are good collectors of data know where the more crime heavy areas of their city are. They know what times are more likely to have those crimes and generate more of those 911 calls. They also, I would imagine, and again, I'm sort of assuming here, but it would surprise me a lot if that most, if not many, departments track where their police officers drive. I mean, there's GPS in those cars, I would imagine.
Oh, they're absolutely tracking all of that.
Yeah. So, so if they see, you know, using my police officer that I spoke with a couple of years ago, this example that he spends half his shift driving through the quiet streets where I live, where during those hours, they're getting a bunch of calls for service and crimes reported 3 miles away, at some point, they're going to run that through a program and say, hey, officer so-and-so, we need you to spend less time here and more time there. And that sort of makes sense, right? I think if he's spending 80% of his time on my quiet street and trying to avoid doing work, that's bad. So there's a balance there. We're probably already to this point, but if we're not, it's certainly going to get more so that we measure everything. We have data on everything. We have sensors that we can feed into programs that will tell you if you're being as efficient as possible. And I guess maybe the big question to you is, do we overvalue efficiency?
I think we misvalue it.
Okay.
Efficiency is very important. Being able to do something with the minimum of waste. Interesting, if you look at the history of the word efficiency, we find it rising in use along with industrialization. So as we start building a lot of factories in this country in the 1920s, 1930s, you find all of a sudden the use of the word efficiency goes way up. And this is at the same time that there's all these studies on how do we maximize employee output in these factories.
Assembly lines was one of the first examples I mentioned.
Yeah. And there's all these efficiency experts that are studying this. And, you know, and so it's some of the really early uses of analytics, you know, in the workplace is in factories. We still use the word all the time. It's expanded from what used to be just the workplace into really all of life. How do we be more efficient in all kinds of tasks around the house, right? That's not a bad thing as long as we recognize that our brains need times of disengagement. The law enforcement example is a good one because they've been using analytics for a long time in kind of figuring out how to optimize the use of the limited human capacity they have to reduce crime in neighborhoods. There's a lot of factories and so forth that use analytics all the time, but there's many other workplaces that don't. And this is where I worry that the ones that don't have a history of really understanding this are going to be implementing AI and causing a lot of stress for people. That we'll be doing it in our personal lives as well.
But like you say, adding stress to people, but using my first example of this journalist who could not quite figure out how to scrape up and stitch together these PDFs, and AI was able to take what was a 1 hour of frustration into a 3 minute task. I mean, that's great. I mean, I didn't talk to him, but I'm sure he's wow, this is a great tool. And this reduces the frustration. And also, by the way, makes me more efficient so I can focus on the things that I know I need to do. So, I mean, there's some good sides of this. And I think what you're saying is that we're not only going to identify ways that reduce frustrations, because, I mean, that's something everybody probably celebrates, but also looking for ways to redirect us to doing things that we also might not want to do, but some computer algorithm says it helps make the company more profitable.
Yeah. So can I tell you, I have limited experience with AI, mm-hmm. but let me give you an example.
Sure.
I'm just starting to find a few uses where I feel comfortable with it. I don't want to use AI for my writing. I think it's really important for my own mental health that my writing be something that I'm producing. Putting aside the questions of the ethics of using AI for creative tasks that then you put your name on. But I just don't use it for that. But I think I've told the story before where I, like during COVID, I found out that my great-grandfather had been a columnist.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the historical archives in for the state of North Dakota, and I was able to recover about, I think it was 420-some columns that he had written for his local newspaper over the course of a dozen years or so, and got them as PDFs. Many of them, they're microfilm images, and so many of them were not, the photographs weren't very high quality. So they're blurry and so forth. And there's misspellings and discrepancies in the spelling and so forth because the journalistic standards of a local newspaper were not that great.
Especially in a small town in North Dakota.
Yeah. Yeah. In the 1930s.
Yeah.
Right. I think they're of historical interest. I mean, I've read through most of them. They're really interesting. A lot of them are quite funny. I think they provide kind of a snapshot of small town life in America in the 1930s and early 40s. And they're certainly interesting as family history. So if nothing else, I'd like to get them, digitize them and put them into a little volume. But I think the selection of them might have some historical interest as well. So I've been wanting to do this as a project, but to sit down and type out, I figured out it takes me on average, an hour and a half per column.
And there are 600
there are different lists, about 420. So like this is a huge time commitment. And it's something like at the end of the day in the evening, it's just hard to do to, you put in another like 3 hours of work to do a couple columns in the evening is an onerous task. But I had started, I'd started like doing them occasionally, but I was thinking, I'm not going to live long enough to get these done. And OCR, this optical character recognition programs, were not good enough. When I would put some of these blurry PDFs into that, it would just produce gibberish.
Because it doesn't understand the context of the sentences.
No context. Yeah. So it just tries to interpret each individual letter, and you can't even figure out like what this is. And so that wasn't any good. But then I found my son, I was talking to him about it, and he uses a lot of different AI programs with his work, and he suggested a couple, and I tried some. And I found the best one was Microsoft Copilot. Mm-hmm. Did a pretty good job of transcribing. So what it's doing is it's using OCR, but then it's interpreting the context. Now, sometimes, like, its interpretation is way off of what the original is, but most of the time, I would say, like about 90% of the time, it's accurate. That still leaves about 10% that I have to reread carefully. By putting this into Microsoft Copilot, getting a digitized version back, and then reading it and comparing it to the original, I'm able to digitize a column accurately in about a half hour on average.
And that's efficiency.
Yeah. Saving me about an hour per column.
Yeah.
So I started doing this, and I was doing it over the Christmas break. So between Christmas and New Year's, I was doing several of these. But I was also noticing that like I would be exhausted after doing this for a couple of hours because it was saving me from the task of just sitting in and typing a bunch of things, which is not really intense work. And in a way, it's kind of boring, kind of boring, kind of relaxing. And then it takes focus once in a while when real blurry passages, I would have to figure out what's going on. But then the rest of it, I'm just breezing through. Now what I'm doing is I'm reading this and I'm just focusing on those blurry passages and I'm finding like when I look at my stress levels wearing a health tracker on my watch, after doing say four of these, which takes me about 2 hours, it's all medium to high stress. I'm exhausted afterwards.
Because you're fully engaged those whole all that time.
Yeah. So it's saving me time, but it's stressful work. And you think, like, why is that stressful? I'm not sure. It takes really intense focus. And if I'm not using the intense focus, like, there's nothing to do because the AI is doing all the kind of the mundane.
The breezy stuff, yeah.
Yeah. And I was thinking, like, what if this is my job? what if this is my job? Could I do this 8 hours a day? And I'm thinking, like, no, I would be completely drained before I got to 8 hours. Not that it's physically demanding. It's just intellectually demanding in a way that now maybe I would get accustomed to it and so forth. But I do see, like, what is going on here is that I foresee that a lot of tasks are going to be like this, where we're using AI, but then, like, our job as humans is in monitoring it, we enter into the work only in the most stressful, most highly engaged times. And this might be very difficult for us.
And I think there's a lot of truth to what you said. I mean, if you talk to some futurists who kind of predict what our world may be 10, 20 years from now, is that that AI is going to greatly change the landscape of many professions, and that maybe you said, could I do this 8 hours a day, was the question you asked yourself. Well, maybe we'll get to a point, I mean, I'm not predicting this, that some people are, is that a workday is going to shrink greatly, that you're going to, the people will be, at, because we're going to have AI doing so much of our busy work, so much of the merging of PDFs, so much of the transcribing, so much of the mundane tasks, that when us humans have to enter into it, it is going to be deep focused work. But maybe that means our work days are going to be 4 or 5 hours long instead of 8 hours, because more is going to be asked of us. I mean, is that like a good trade-off if we could get to that point? Is that we're really working with a capital W, but during a shorter period of time, that the amount of time we're doing that in a day or in a week is greatly reduced, giving us more time to ourselves. Would that be a good trade-off in your mind?
I have two big concerns with that. First is that human beings only really feel happy when they're being useful. And work is the primary way in which we feel useful. We contribute to society, towards our family, towards our community.
And right now, for many people, that's 40-some hours a week.
Yeah. And that is why when you ask people, like, who are you, and they describe the work that they do, it's like what they're telling you is the way in which they're engaged with society and contribute to society. And that's really important. And so if we're working less, is it just a matter of time, or is our feeling of usefulness, or is our feeling of the extent to which we contribute to the well-being of others, to the good of society, is that decreasing? And that's problematic. So that's concern number one. The other thing is, most companies are not in the business of providing salaries to local residents. They're in the business of making money for their shareholders, mm-hmm. and their investors. So how is the wealth that's being generated by the companies being distributed? And this is then going to be a governmental question. Yes. We're going to have laws and regulations in which we become much more of a socialist country than we already are. We've already adopted a lot of socialist ways of governing and distributing wealth, but we have to be much more like that. And I'm not optimistic that we will do it, or that we will do it without a great deal of conflict.
And this probably takes us into a little bit different territory, but that's interesting you say that, and it kind of rings true to me. But you also at the same time hear people, whether they're companies or company leaders, who are pushing AI adoption because of reasons like efficiency, and because you can invest in certain companies and make a whole lot of cash. And you can probably do more work with fewer people, all the things we know about. And these are all very capitalistic impulses. At the same time, what you're saying is, if all that works, that means that as a society, we're going to have to take about 4 steps back from capitalism, because the model that we've known in this country for, well, many generations starts to fall apart.
Yeah, because every new technology, what it does is it concentrates production, which then also concentrates wealth. So it concentrates wealth into the hands of those who own and use the technology. What AI is, like, this really powerful form of technology that is going to greatly concentrate production into the hands of the investors. And so then The question is, how does all the interest in productivity, the wealth generated by that productivity, how does it get distributed if the wealth is so concentrated? That's going to be highly controversial because we are still a country with kind of an individualistic ethos and a really hard work ethic. And so, like, you're earning your worth as a result of how much work and how much contribution you make to others. Technologies concentrate that. So, like, the amount of your effort isn't correlated to the amount of production. It's production is correlated to technology, not to effort. That doesn't go along with the work ethic. And so I don't know what we're going to do, because I just see, like, this historical ethos of American society is really at odds with the form of economics that we're going to need for an AI society.
As we close, I want to take us out of the future and into the present here. That you talked a few minutes ago about how if you're writing something and maybe get stuck, or you are thinking about possibly a lecture or class that you're going to give and want to think about it more deeply, you'll often take away and step away from your desk, go on a walk, go out in nature. We've talked a number of times on this show how you think that nature is a great place to sort of expand our thinking. And when we're out in nature, it takes us to places outside of ourselves. Maybe you can talk a little bit more for people who do find themselves regularly feeling like that police officer who spends so much time in the most difficult and challenging parts of his job and needs to step away and take some time. And as the author of the Wall Street Journal piece that we'll link to says, the benefits of lull, L-U-L-L, the benefits of quiet time and reflection. How can you build that into your workflow so you don't constantly feel overwhelmed? Because although AI may take a lot of our work from us, a lot of people don't feel like that today.
This is where we need a real intentional and cultural shift, where these times of lull, or the periods of time in between the high-intensity tasks, where our brain is in a recovery mode, that was necessitated by the sheer amount of kind of mundane tasks that have to be done so that you didn't have to schedule it. What technology has done is really, really shortened that, minimize those number of mundane tasks in many kinds of roles. AI promises to do it much more. So the mundane tasks aren't a matter of course that we can just think, oh, we need to figure out how to minimize them. Instead, we have to schedule them in. And you can't just schedule in empty time. The brain doesn't recover by doing nothing at all. Like, this,
like, is watching TV count?
No, it's...
Or scrolling through TikTok count?
No, because then that's a different form of engagement. What we're going to have to do increasingly is schedule time for brain recovery. And you have to do it by paying attention to after doing a task for a certain amount of time, do you feel more rested or do you feel more exhausted? And for most people who are scrolling through TikTok, they feel more tired. They don't feel rested after doing that. And so that's a good cue that your brain is not in recovery mode. Listening to music, probably in recovery mode. But doing creative tasks, you feel more rested. Not high intensity ones, but doing things like painting.
Creating something.
Working with your hands on things, but also like taking a walk, go out socializing, visiting with a friend. You know, this is why, like, in many offices, you know, people that are like out in the hall and talking with one another, those are really important times. And they have to be seen as like maybe times that should be scheduled in. Like, if I'm working for an hour, have I scheduled in 10 minutes where I'm just going to walk down the hall and talk to some people? But I think it's going to become increasingly important for us to really pay attention to the kinds of activities that allow our brains to be in recovery mode and put that into the schedule, because everything about our environment right now is taking those times out of our schedule.
And it's interesting, you were talking about when you were doing your using AI, using Microsoft Copilot to help transcribe the columns from the 1930s, And you described to me how this, using that technology, increased the efficiency, but it also increased your stress level, possibly. And how did you know that, Rick? Because you had a sensor on your arm that told you that. And I guess some might see a little irony that you had to rely on a gadget to tell you how you were feeling. And maybe you knew that you were just using that as a reinforcement tool. I'm not sure. But I think that the reason I bring that up is that we can use smartly technology to do those very things you just outlined, to maybe measure how we're feeling and to find ways to structure that free time. I think there are ways for technology to play a role in that, right?
So I wear a smartwatch, but it's a minimal one. It's a Garmin one, but it does have the stress indicator, which uses HRV, heart rate variability, which is an indicator of how much stress you're under. You don't need something like that. You can tell when you're getting more tired and when you're feeling more rested, but it just kind of fine tunes. And I've been fascinated with this for the past year or so, really kind of looking into this so I can fine tune different times during my day, because I'm just finding it harder as technologies advance and make us more efficient. I'm finding it harder to maintain that kind of balance that we need. And so I find that form of technology to be useful at kind of fine tuning. Where can I even find 5 or 10 minutes of rest during a day? What are the times when I can look back over what I did during the day, and then I can compare to my stress levels and say, oh, when I was doing these activities, I had really low stress during those times. I just need to build a few more of those in. Not as time wasters, but so that I can engage in the really high intensity things that I need to do to get my work done.
I'm curious, do you wear that device to bed?
Yeah.
And so there's probably a lot of things I don't do well. One thing I think I do pretty well is a lot of people will complain as they get older about they can't sleep as well. I like 9 nights out of 10 sleep very well. And so I feel good about that. But there was a short time a couple of years ago where I had this like wearable that would measure my sleep. So I'm like, I think I'm pretty good at this. I'm going to see. And like generally the answer was yes. But like every morning I would like, first thing I would do is like check my sleep score or whatever it's called. And then I'd be like, oh, I bet I can do. And it was like almost like building in stress. So before I go to bed, like, well, tonight I want to get even a higher score than last night, which is like ridiculous because you can't really, I guess there's like on the edges you can try to, you know, set you up for success, but a lot of it's beyond your control. And I just found after like a week that this is like adding stress to the process, not taking it away. So I do think there are times that we can over measure our lives and our stress levels and our performance of sleeping.
When I first started paying attention to these stress levels, I would sometimes, you know, I'd be lying in bed and I'd be thinking about all the things that need to be done the next day. And I could tell that I'm feeling stressed just by thinking about all the things that are on my list that I have to do. And I would check my watch and sure enough, the stress is going up. And so then I'm thinking, oh, and then I really need to get a lot of rest. And the more I think about that, the more stress levels go up. And so I realize, yeah, I can't be paying attention to this minute by minute or even hour by hour. I need to check once in a while to see where I am, but mainly looking back. And then implement some changes. So one of the things that's been really significant for me is that I don't drink alcohol before bed anymore. And it used to be fairly common. I'd have a glass of wine, you know, before bed or watch TV, you know, like 8, 9 o'clock, have a glass of wine. What I found is that it takes about 4 hours or so for the stress levels to come down to the range of really good quality sleep after drinking alcohol. So I might have a drink like at 5 or 6 o'clock, but I'm not going to do it at 9 o'clock anymore. And that's really changed the quality. So like little things like that. I've also found that having something that my mind is actually focused on is much better at reducing stress levels than trying to think of nothing,
mm-hmm.
right? Trying to think of nothing, trying to stop thinking about what's worrying you, adds stress, because then you add one more task that you're trying to do. But if you can get your mind to focus on something that's really taking your mind off of these other tasks, you can really relax. And so that's been a key. So I try to find something like breaks during the day where I'll focus on music, have a conversation with somebody, but something that's fully engaged me in my mind, but at low intensity levels. And so just building these sorts of things. So I found the technology really useful for that.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, I hear you have one for me.
Have I got a dilemma for you, Scott? This did not happen to me, I want to say. I was talking to some people recently who had been invited to participate in weddings, and I was kind of looking at them thinking like, boy, that's going to be really expensive. I wonder how they're going to afford all this. Because lots of times when you're a young person, you're starting out on life, and we know that weddings have gotten much more expensive.
Yes.
So let's say, for example, that you have an old friend who asks you if you'll be part of the wedding party. And you're really flattered by this. You say, sure, I would love to. And then you find out that you have to travel quite a ways for it. This is going to be a fairly fancy wedding, so you're going to have to rent a tux, but it's at a place where the rental prices are really high, and there's all these other expenses. And you realize this is going to cost you a lot more than you were thinking of when you agreed to be part of the wedding. And you don't have the funds to pay for it without putting it all on credit cards. And you've just worked really hard for the last few years to pay down your credit card debt. So what do? Do you say, suck it up and it's worth it, so put this on credit cards even though it's going to cost a lot? Or do you call your friend and say, you know, I've reconsidered this. I really can't afford it. I'd love to be part of the wedding, but I just can't afford it. So what do you do?
I mean, obviously, neither of those is a great decision, right? And you haven't really told. I mean, usually big expensive weddings like this are planned out farther in advance. So, I mean, part of this would be, have you come to this realization 6 months before the wedding day or 6 weeks before the wedding day? Because that makes a lot of difference, it seems to me. Maybe I'll answer your question and then I'll take it in a little different way. I think if it's like 6 months before the wedding, I think you're probably okay to say, you know, upon further review, this is probably not going to work for me, but giving your friend and the wedding people time to adjust, I think that's probably fine. You know, it gets down to 6 weeks or a month before, and all of a sudden you realize this, unless there is like a sudden change, like you just lost your job or some other significant financial calamity, that I think maybe you're a little more locked in. So that to me is sort of how I would look at that. But the bigger issue here is that I think, and maybe this is something that I've learned while doing this show, and maybe hopefully we've imparted onto loyal listeners of this show, especially when we talk at the end here about these ethical dilemmas, is that it is I would say if there's like one theme to all of these, it is do the right thing the first time, meaning that like offer was first made to you, do you want to be in my wedding? And of course, hopefully you ask the question like, hey, tell me more about what you have planned. And you learn that it's going to be on a mountaintop in Hawaii. Well, that's going to be different than at the Presbyterian Church downtown. And that I think getting the facts early and making a wise decision early based on as much material as you can is almost always going to put you in a better position than sort of instinctively saying something or agreeing to something or deciding something. And then once that something gets closer on the calendar, having second thoughts. I think being more intentional and thoughtful early on when the stakes seem lower is probably almost never the right call. So I don't know. So I guess to summarize, to answer your question, a lot of it depends on the timing of this is for how you respond to your friend. But really the original sin here is not thinking about this from the jump, because if this friend approached you and said, hey, I want you to do this, and then you say, let me think about it, and you call him back the next day and say, hey, this just isn't going to work for me, and here's why. I mean, that's not that awkward. If you'd have that discussion like 18 months after he asks you and 3 weeks before the wedding day, that's really awkward. So yeah. I think the lesson we should all learn is to be more intentional about these things from the start.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And I wasn't thinking so much of the timing of it, but a lot of what you how you respond depends on the timing and how your response affects the burden on the other person. When you promise, when you agree to something, you're basically promising.
Yeah.
Because that you establish expectations for that person. And then are you worried at all about what happens to the friendship?
Oh, sure.
Like, even if you give the person lots of time, but just saying, no, I can't really afford to do it. Are you worried about that this is going to affect your friendship down the road?
I mean, I think if you have that conversation, you know, I think if within a week of him asking, and assuming the wedding's not like 2 weeks later, that, yeah, I think in that case, you have a lousy friend if he, A, doesn't understand your situation. And I mean, you could also probably argue that if your friend is planning this destination wedding on a mountaintop in Hawaii, and his family and maybe bride-to-be is like pretty wealthy, and many of his friends are and her friends are pretty wealthy, and doesn't think for a minute that, like, he knows that you're not pretty wealthy and knows that you probably can't just take 10 days off work and spend time and a flight and all this. I mean, if that person is that has that big a blind spot about your life and realizes that this is a big ask, well, maybe that person, I hate to say isn't a good friend, but certainly isn't a very aware of your situation. And I think at times maybe you have to remind him that not everybody's life is, well, you know, able to just jet off to Hawaii mountaintops at the drop of a hat.
We've just been talking here just now. I was thinking, I wonder how, like, what's happened with friendships with the people that were in our wedding. We had a fairly big wedding, and realize on both sides, both the groomsmen and bridesmaids, like, there's several of them we've lost contact with completely.
Huh.
And you think of, like, at the time when you're young, especially when you're getting married at a young age, you think the people that you're going to invite to be part of the wedding are going to be your friends for life. But you don't know that because your social relationships change over time.
And how old were you when you got married? I should know.
Let's see. How old was I? I think I was 23.
So 23. So that was, yeah, that's a very different point in your life. And I'm guessing a lot of these people were from people you knew when you were 13.
Yeah, and a couple of them, people I met in college, some of them had been friends for much longer than that, and our lives had just gone different directions, you know, and so we don't socially interact anymore just because we're so far apart.
Yeah, and that's actually a good reminder, too, is that, I mean, you were 23, and so that's, you know, back when I was 23 and were in this situation, that would even be more different, because I think these all seem like super high stakes decisions at the time. And obviously getting married, you know, is a very high stakes decision, but like agreeing to participate in the wedding party of someone who you know pretty well at age 23 is probably not like a hugely high stakes decision.
Yeah, but for me, this just confirms what, like, I've been saying for a long time, and for any young people thinking about marriage that I can talk to, I say, put your emotional investment in the marriage, not in the wedding.
But okay, I agree, first of all. But here, I had a question just popped into my head, though. You're right that weddings have gotten more expensive for many people and have gotten more elaborate and all those things we know. And those are like the ultimate events, right? These are like, and sometimes spectacles, like, and I mean, in kind of a good way, but I mean that you're bringing all these people together for, you know, several hours and you have catering and you have all the expenses we know. It does seem weird, though, that in a world right now where we seem to value, you know, third places less, personal relationships less, where we seem to not want to have these outside of our home social gatherings as much as we used to. It seems like I could see a world that everything about our society is as it is today, but like weddings become a much less big of a deal, right? That there's not this, like these people kind of look back at, oh, I remember when my parents got married and they invited 100 people and the church was filled and flowers and pictures and throwing a rice. And, you know, today we just, me and my spouse got together and it was not a big deal because like we don't know that many people and we don't like to leave the house and we could actually, there's an app I think that we actually ordered in the minister to come to our house. You know, I mean, it could be like, I'm almost surprised that that weddings haven't gotten smaller over the years. I don't know why that is. It's just like a thing that occurred to me as you were talking. I don't know if you have any theories, like as I throw this at you.
I do have a theory about it. It's the demise of ritual. And ritual are the ways in which we mark certain stages in our life and kind of a mark a place within a community of people. And so weddings used to be follow a pretty ritualistic procedure. There was a number of things that were done, and everybody did it pretty much the same way. You'd get married in a church. You would have a reception, sometimes in the church basement or a hall local.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
But nearby. But then there was the wedding cake. There's the toasts. There's the throwing of the bouquet.
You'd have a below average buffet meal.
Yeah, but the important thing was the like all of these things had a kind of symbolism to it, all the part, because it's a recognition by the community of a new kind of identity for the couple, right?
To becoming one.
And that's that in all, now weddings have become more of a spectacle. They're more of a big party and—
An Instagram event.
And there's a real emphasis on making it unique, making it memorable, and not doing it like everybody else does it. And so the more it's like unique and memorable in that way, the more it's a spectacle, the less significance it has as a kind of transition into a new state of life. And so that's why I think that's what's going on. And so then you have some say, well, I don't want the big spectacle. And so then they don't do the public wedding at all. They make just a private ceremony, but then they both miss out, both the spectacle and the private ceremony miss out on that, the important part of the community recognizing and giving their blessing to this new state of life for a couple.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life Podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.